as Adam has just said, for us, the Marxists, the Russian Revolution of 1917 was the greatest single event in the whole of human history. Because here, for the first time, if we exclude that glorious but tragic episode of Paris Commune, for the first time the working class succeeded in overthrowing the old order of tyranny and at least began the task, great task, of the socialist transformation of society. Now, of course, particularly for the last 20 years, since the collapse of the Soviet Union, there has been a colossal campaign of slanders and calumnies against the Bolshevik Revolution, against Lenin, against Trotsky. They tell the most appalling lies, which are repeated and repeated and repeated. What's the matter? Speak from there. I'll speak from there if you want. Marvels of modern technology, comrades. Now, the question you must ask yourself is why? I mean, there's a whole industry, it's a very profitable industry, producing books attacking the Russian Revolution. The answer, why do they do this? It's not an accident, and it's not the first time that this has happened. Because for the ruling class, it is never sufficient just to defeat a revolution. It is necessary to slander and to lie and to insult and to blacken the name of the revolution and to wipe it out from the common consciousness, to eradicate the memory of the revolution in order to prevent the new generation from understanding and learning from the past. One of the most absurd lies which they constantly repeat is, well, the Russian Revolution never achieved anything. Soviet Union apparently never achieved anything. That is a blatant and monstrous lie which flies in the face of the facts. What did the Russian Revolution prove? The Russian Revolution and the USSR, in spite of all that happened subsequently under Stalinism, all these horrors, it's true, nevertheless succeeded in proving something extremely important. It proved beyond the shadow of a doubt, not in the language of dialectics, not in the three volumes of Capital, but in the language of steel, of coal, of cement, of oil, of warfare, even of space travel. What did it prove? That it is possible to administer a gigantic economy of a subcontinent, a gigantic country of 150 million people, without private bankers, without capitalists, without landlords, and yes, to achieve excellent results. Because the Soviet Union did achieve unparalleled, extraordinary results. In order to understand that achievement, you have to use your imagination. Try and imagine the situation that existed before 1917. What kind of country was Tsarist Russia? It was an extremely backward country, a semi-feudal economy, far more backward than Pakistan is today. Far more backward. The bulk of the population were illiterate. Just to put this in figures, do you know how many workers there were in Russia in 1917? Industrial workers, 3.5 million. That's a tiny working class in a population of 150 million. And even if you include all sectors of mining, transport, and all the other sectors, the Russian proletariat in 1917 was no more than 10 million. I repeat, out of a population of 150 million. It was a picture of backwardness. And yet, on the basis of just 2 5-year plans, despite all the horrors of bureaucracy, Stalinism, and so on, that's a separate question. That was the product of the isolation of Russia in a backward country. But in 2 5-year plans, a socialist planned economy transformed Russia from a Pakistan almost to an America. The Soviet Union became one of the great economic powers of the world. And they say that nothing was achieved. History has never known such a transformation as that in such a short space of time. And it shows the colossal potential of a nationalized planned economy. Now, let's again try to use a little imagination. It's a very difficult thing to do. But I want you to try to imagine the conditions that the Russian Marxists had to work in 100 years ago. Russia was not only a very backward country with a tiny working class. Russia, and people don't remember this. Tsarist Russia occupied the same place or approximately a similar place in European politics that American imperialism occupies in world politics at the present time. It was the most reactionary country in the entire world. Tsarist Russia was the bastion, the bulwark of European reaction. Tsarist Russia was the country that smashed the revolutions of 1848, that crushed every single insurrection of the Polish people. And when you consider the objective conditions which the Russian Marxists had to work in, particularly at the beginning, when they were very small, I sometimes think that we're a little bit spoiled, comrades. We're a little bit spoiled. We complain too much. Oh, the objective conditions are very difficult. How many times have I heard that? Just think of the objective situations that the Bolsheviks that the Russian Marxists had to face 100 years ago. Tsarism was an iron dictatorship, a powerful autocratic regime. The Tsarist monarchy, they said, had lasted for 1,000 years. The Tsar had the most powerful army, one of the most powerful armies in the world. A huge police force designed for internal repression. You had the Cossacks, a special military force, again for repression. And he had a very, very efficient secret police. So efficient that they infiltrated all left-wing groups. The Bolsheviks only discovered in 1917, after the revolution, when they opened the files of the secret police, the Okhrana, it was called, the Okhrana, that the secret police had infiltrated at the very top levels of the party since the founding Congress. The head of the Bolshevik parliamentary faction in 1912, a man who was trusted by Lenin, who was close to Lenin, a former metal worker, Roman Malinovsky, was a police agent. There were two police agents in the Prague Founding Congress of the Bolshevik Party. They didn't know each other, by the way. Yes, comrades, but all these things did not prevent the Bolsheviks from coming to power in October 1917. Now, 1917 was the most extraordinary political change in history. At the beginning of the revolution in February, the Bolsheviks party was very small. It was a small minority of the working class. It was a small minority in the Soviets. And yet, in the space of 9 months, which is nothing, 9 months, this small minority became transformed into the decisive majority, a party of more than 100,000 members, maybe 150,000, I don't know the actual, that won the majority of the Soviets, and I hope I will prove today that the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917 was the most democratic, the most representative, and the most popular revolution in the whole of history. Contrary to all the lies they say about a conspiracy of a tiny handful of people and so on. From 8,000 to a party that was capable of putting itself at the heads of millions. I do not believe that you will find a comparable example in the history of any political party in any other country in the world. And therefore, even if you're not a Bolshevik, even if you don't agree with the Russian Revolution, which I hope you all do in this hall at least, this is surely an event which deserves the most careful study. You must find the answer to the question, how did they do it? How was it achieved? In order to answer that question, we have to go a little bit further back to the first Russian Revolution of 1905, because this was the third, the Bolshevik Revolution was really the third revolution. The first revolution of 1905 was a very important anticipation. It was a preparatory ground. It was like a dress rehearsal of a play. It would be very good if we had time to discuss the 1905 revolution, which is a very important thing. But that is a that would require a separate discussion. And as I said the other day, I must repeat this point. The Russian workers emerged on the stage of history in January 1905, not on a very high level. So please, let's have no more of this petty bourgeois nonsense about the masses on a low level of consciousness. Let's hear no more of this nonsense. I've already said what the level of the Russian workers was. The big majority were illiterate. The big majority were, almost all of them were extremely religious. They drank a lot of vodka. Politically, up to that point, they supported the Tsar, the little father, the Batyushka. And on the first mass demonstration of the Russian proletariat, which is on the 9th of January, 1905, the workers demonstrated, this was a peaceful demonstration, led by a priest, by Father Gapon, who was also a police agent, by the way. In their hands, they carried not red flags, but pictures of the Virgin Mary, religious icons. And when the revolutionaries asked permission to participate in the demonstration, the organizers very reluctantly accepted them, but they said go to the back. No, and no red flags. That saved their life. That saved their life. Because the Tsar's Cossacks and the army was waiting for them, and they opened fire. It killed thousands of people. You never know how many people were killed. And that meant a sudden transformation of the consciousness of the Russian workers in a question of hours. They became revolutionaries. They formed Soviets. And this is an important point. Workers are not little children. Let me ask you a question. Where did the idea of Soviets come from? You will not find that idea in the writings of Marx or Engels or Lenin or Trotsky before 1905. It was a wonderful, creative discovery of the Russian workers themselves. It shows the creativity of the working class once they move into struggle. Therefore, the 1905 revolution was important because of the emergence of the Soviets, which, by the way, what is a Soviet? The Russian word Soviet merely means a council. It can mean advice, actually. It's a council. These were all that the Soviets in 1905 were extended strike committees. That's all they were, because there were no legal trade unions. The workers had the brilliant idea, why don't we send delegates from the strikers of every factory to a central meeting? A marvelous idea. And by the way, the first president of the St. Petersburg Soviet was a young man of what, 20-something years of age, Leon Trotsky. So the first revolution deserves careful study, but there's no time. After months of struggle, it ended in defeat, with the defeat of the Moscow uprising in December 1905. Then there were some years of black reaction. The regime took revenge. Thousands of people were killed, tortured, hanged. Such was the disappointment and the demoralization that many young comrades actually committed suicide in despair. They thought, well, that's the end. We're finished. It wasn't the end, it was the beginning. Within a few years, by 1912, actually on the basis of an economic boom, again, there were mass strikes. There was the shooting of miners in the gold fields, the Lena gold mine in Siberia, which sparked off mass protest meetings and mass strikes. And between 1912 and 1914, Russia was on the eve of a new revolution when the French president, Poincaré, arrived in Petersburg to negotiate with the Tsar about the forthcoming war. He was horrified to see barricades and red flags in the street. Part of the reason why the Tsarist regime entered the war, part of the reason, was precisely to cut across the revolution, which they succeeded in doing. But the important point about the period 1912 to 1914 is that the Bolshevik Party already was the main force among the organized workers in Russia. Perhaps three-quarters of the organized workers in Russia supported the Bolsheviks. And if there would have been a revolution in 1914, which was possible, it would have immediately brought the Bolshevik party to power. But all that was cut across by the war. At the beginnings of every war, there is a wave of patriotism, of flag waving, of nationalism. And in the case of Russia, which is a predominantly peasant country, the whole of the young people were called into the army. Most of the active workers were called into the army, where the presence of the working class was drowned in a sea of backward peasants. Now, this was a terrible period, terrible period. Again, I repeat, comrades, you complain too much. You complain too much about alleged difficult objective situations. Just look at the position that Lenin was in. From 1914, he was forced to go into exile in Switzerland. He was completely cut off, completely isolated from the movement in Russia. Now, of course, nowadays we have mobile phones and we have Facebook and we have internet and all kinds of nice things. Well, Lenin didn't have any of those things. Just imagine, Adam, Lenin didn't have Facebook. How could he exist without Facebook? But just think about it. Just to get a letter into Russia, across the battlefields, the military dictatorships, just to send a letter was a colossal effort. It was an extremely difficult period. There could be no question of strikes and demonstrations in Russia at that time. They'd be immediately crushed. But the laws of dialectics still continue, even in the most difficult position. And beneath the surface, a new situation was developing. In all countries, a feeling of tiredness, of rage, of anger, of frustration against this unjust war. The hunger, the food shortages, the inflation behind the front, which the women, of course, had to bear the brunt of that. The men were in the army, but the women had to put up with this. And therefore, the basis for a new revolution was being laid. Even then was being laid. And yet, even Lenin, who was a very optimistic man. I think even Lenin began to have doubts, not about the general future of socialism, but at least about the immediate prospects. Now, there's a famous incident. In January 1917, notice the date, January 1917, Lenin was speaking to a meeting of Swiss young socialists. By the way, you notice he was conducting work in the Swiss Socialist Party, of course. Especially the young socialists. And he said the following words. He said, "Well, I'm an old man." It's not true, actually. He was younger than me. He wasn't old at all. But he said it anyway. He said, "I'm an old man, and probably I'll never live to see the socialist revolution. It's up to you, the youth, the new generation." Lenin said those words in January 1917. A few weeks later, he received the news that the Tsarist regime had been overthrown by the working class. The February Revolution, the second revolution, had broken out. By the way, not prepared by anybody, not called by anybody. It came from the mass of the workers and the soldiers themselves. And by the way, guess who played the leading role in February 1917? It was the women workers of Petrograd. Well, as I said, they had to put up with the brunt of all this suffering. Now, on Sunday, I quoted from the Bible, "For the first shall be last, and the last shall be first." You see that in every revolution. Because the women, who are ordinary, raw, unorganized working class women, wanted to organize a strike and a demonstration on the 8th of March, as it was in the new calendar. You'll forgive me if I use the old Russian calendar, but I'm an old-fashioned guy, as most of you probably realize. But it is the equivalent of the 8th of March. It was in February at that time. The women workers, not the petty bourgeois feminists, I'm not talking about them, played no role whatever. The proletarian women in the factories wanted to organize a strike and a demonstration. And when they went to the Bolshevik committee, there was a Bolshevik committee in Petrograd, the Bolsheviks advised them, "No, don't do that, don't strike, don't demonstrate. You're going to be massacred, you're going to be killed." So the women said in good Russian, which I could say it in Russian, but I will not, "Oh yes, get lost, bugger you. We're going out anyway. They ignore the advice of the advanced element. You see these advanced people, how advanced they are. They ignore the advanced. They ignore the vanguard. You know, Babak, the vanguard in Iran, the vanguard. Yes, the people in Iran also ignored the vanguard, fortunately. They ignored them. And they went on the streets. And that immediately sparked off a general uprising of the workers, general strikes, demonstrations, mutinies in the army. Now, I advise you all to read the most important book on this question. And if you've read it already, read it again. It is a marvelous book. It's one of the wonders of 20th century literature. Apart from history and politics, it's marvelous literature. I'm referring to Trotsky's History of the Russian Revolution. And you can read there a detailed account of the whole of 1917. And he recounts a phone conversation between the head of the Tsar and the head of his army. And it says in so many words, why don't you do something? Why don't you move the army to suppress this? I can't. I haven't got any troops. Why don't you move the 1st Division? There is no 1st Division. They've gone over. Why don't you move the 5th Division? And so on and so forth. In other words, as in Egypt, as in Tunisia, in the moment of truth, this gigantic army of repression was a gigantic zero. Even the Cossacks were affected, and they were the most reactionary section. Trotsky recalls one little incident which sticks in my mind. There was a demonstration of workers, and they were confronted by Cossacks on horseback. It's not very nice to be attacked by a Cossack on horseback. So one of the workers went under the belly of the horse. And the Cossack just sat there and did nothing. And then other workers did the same. And one of the workers reported that the Cossack winked at him like that. That wink was a very significant gesture. It shows that, you see, the forces of repression, once the masses begin to move, once they're confronted by the mass, that is it. One important thing which Lenin said in 1917, of course he said many important things, but he said the following: the masses, the working class, is always more revolutionary than the most revolutionary party. Don't forget that. The events of 1917 demonstrate that. The Bolsheviks actually lagged behind. The ones in Petersburg, in Petrograd, lagged behind. And particularly the leaders lagged behind. Kamenev and Stalin were the first leaders to arrive back. They were in Siberia. They came back soon. Trotsky was in America, and Lenin was still struggling to get out of Switzerland. And they immediately capitulated. They dropped all perspective of socialist revolution. What's the reason for this? Well, first of all, there's a law that in a revolutionary situation, the leadership of the revolutionary party always comes under intense pressure from the ruling, from other classes, from alien classes. This is particularly the case in the beginnings of a mass popular revolution. Which, by the way, when I say a mass revolution, it's not only the workers that are involved. It's not only the advanced layers that are involved. It's the more backward layers, the most backward layers, are stirred up. If you like, it's a revolution. It's the entry of the politically uneducated masses come onto the scene, the peasants and so on. And they bring all their confusions and all their prejudices. And at the beginning of the revolution, as I've pointed out already, you see this in every revolution. You saw it in Venezuela. You've seen it more recently in Egypt than in Tunisia. There's like a carnival atmosphere. You saw it in Spain in 1931 with the fall of the monarchy, the same thing. It's like a big street party. Everybody's happy. Everything seems very easy. They think all the problems have been solved with the fall of the old government. And in that particular moment, the idea of unity is to the forefront. Why are you raising differences? Don't be a sectarian. Support them with the majority. We must all be together. From a dialectical point of view, here you have an undifferentiated mass. It's a bit like the formation of the galaxy. Our galaxy started as an undifferentiated cloud of undifferentiated matter. Only gradually it crystallizes into planets and so on. In the course of experience, the undifferentiated masses, this is going to, the contradictions will emerge, and different tendencies will crystallize, and there'll be a polarization to the right and to the left. But initially, the demand is for unity. Of course, that suited the opportunist politicians, the Mensheviks, the SRs, who came to the top, who came to the fore. Why did these parties come to the fore? Because in 1914, the Bolsheviks were the majority. But in February, and it is very important that you understand this, the Bolsheviks were a small minority in the Soviets. The big majority supported the opportunist party, the reformists, if you like, the Russian Papandreous, if you like. This is, they supported the leaders of the Mensheviks and the SRs, which are really petty bourgeois tendencies. Now, what that partly reflected was the uneducated, the low, that there you could refer to the politically uneducated masses who are looking for easy solutions, a shortcut. And the reformists offer them apparently easy solutions. In the case of Russia, however, there's another very important factor. The army, which played a fundamental, the soldiers played a fundamental role, were overwhelmingly peasant. The workers and the Bolsheviks were a small minority in the army. And the peasants, who were illiterate, had respect for what you could say the village intelligentsia. You know, the clever people, the clever people, the people who could speak nice, speak properly, the school teachers, the lawyers, people like that, who were all of the members of the SR party or the Mensheviks. Therefore, the political composition of the Soviet in February reflects this early undifferentiated stage. Now, for the Mensheviks and SRs, this was a bourgeois revolution. For democracy, no question of the working class taking power. And some of the Bolshevik leaders accepted this argument. The main reason they accepted it was under, they were under the pressure of the Democrats, petty bourgeois Democrats. But there was also a theoretical reason. It shows the importance of theory. You see, Lenin made a bit of a mistake before the revolution, before the First World War. He developed a formula which is an ambiguous formula called the democratic dictatorship of the proletariat and the peasantry. And Trotsky pointed that out very early on, that this was a dangerous slogan because it was ambiguous and it did not say which class would lead the dictatorship. You can't have a dictatorship of two classes. And Lenin and Kamenev seized on this ambiguity to justify a capitulation before the petty bourgeois Democrats. Now, Lenin immediately understood, although he was in exile, he immediately understood the position. He immediately sent a telegram to the Bolsheviks in Petrograd, a very interesting telegram. No agreement with other parties. No trust in the bourgeois liberals. Distrust Kerensky particularly. Arming of the working class, the only solution. And so on. In other words, Lenin understood the question immediately. Now, what occurred in February was really, if you like, it was an abortion. On the one hand, the bourgeois liberals immediately set up what they called the provisional government, composed of liberal bourgeois, big bourgeois, like Milyukov, he was a big bourgeois, and with the Prince Lvov, I think he was a cousin of the Tsar, Prince Lvov. And of course, they didn't want the revolution to go any further, they wanted to stop it. But alongside the provisional government, you had the Soviets, which represented the real revolution. The masses looked towards the Soviets. They trusted the leaders of the Soviets. And shamefully, the leaders of the Soviets, of course, the reformists, supported the provisional government. And to their shame, Kamenev and Zinoviev went along with this. Now, when Lenin finally managed to come back, he had to do a deal to cross Germany. It was the only possibility, because the British and the French were not going to let him travel through Sweden. Subsequently, they made a big fuss about this trip through Germany, accusing Lenin that he was a German agent, which is a complete lie, of course. I mean, the Bolsheviks even laid down conditions. that nobody was to get on or get off this train until it got to Russia, to avoid any suspicion that there was any contact with the Germans. And as soon as he got back to Petrograd, Lenin started a struggle inside the Bolshevik Party to change the line of the party. And it was a very sharp struggle. He was virtually isolated in the leadership of the party. It was at that moment that he made the statement that the working class is always more revolutionary than the most revolutionary party. He had to appeal to the workers, to the Bolshevik workers, over the heads of the Central Committee. And of course, the problem was resolved in the famous April conference, where Lenin raised the question, the working class must take power. And he put forward a very famous slogan, which everybody knows, but nobody understands. You know, Hegel said something about that. Let me see if I can remember what he said, Emma. Aber was bekannt ist, ist darum noch nicht erkannt. Is that correct? Is that correct, German? Aber was bekannt ist, ist darum noch nicht erkannt. What is known is not thereby necessarily understood. Everybody knows all power to the Soviets. Yes, but what does it mean? What's the real content of this slogan? Oh, it's a revolution, it's insurrection, it's Soviet power. No. Don't understand. Think. The Soviets at that time were under the control of the reformists, the Russian Papandreous, the Russian Ed Milibands, the Russian Zapateros. And what Lenin was saying to the workers in the Soviets was this. Look, we Bolsheviks are for socialism. We want a socialist revolution. We think that we should expropriate the landlords and capitalists. But you don't agree with us. You think we're a little bit extreme. You think we're too far. Okay. Let's all agree on a common idea. Peace, bread, and land. Do you agree with that? Everybody agrees with it. Okay. Yes, but in order to get those things, the Soviets must take power into their hands. That is to say, he's saying to the Russian Papandreous and the Russian Zapateros, gentlemen, take power, take power. As a matter of fact, he said this in hundreds of speeches in the Soviet. You know, you get these ultra-left sectarians who believe in violence. They believe in blood and bloody revolution. Buckets of blood, and the more blood, the better. Long live violence! That wasn't Lenin's position at all. Lenin said, oh yes, long live civil war as well. What did Lenin say? He said, look, we don't want violence. We don't want civil war. He said it. There's no need for civil war. Just you people take power. Please take power. You can do it. You're the majority. Take power, please. And if you take power, he said, if you take power, I'm not saying that the Greek comes of Papandreou, by the way, just to say. if you take power, he says, we Bolsheviks will discuss. And he said the struggle for power will be reduced to a peaceful debate in the Soviets. That's what he said. And that was correct. It wasn't just rhetoric on Lenin's part. He was telling the truth. The problem was that the Mensheviks and Azad had no intention of taking power. They wanted to cling to the bourgeois liberals. Now, what you see here is precisely flexible tactics and flexible slogans. The bourgeoisie was not capable of solving any of the problems of the bourgeois democratic revolution in Russia, not one. Lenin's slogans represented the concrete reality of the situation in Russia. It represented what the workers wanted, what the peasants wanted. They wanted peace, an end to this war. They wanted bread because the families were hungry. And the peasants wanted land. But the bourgeoisie couldn't grant any of these things. They couldn't grant peace because they were tied to the Allies, to the French and German imperial, the French and English imperialists. And from London and from Paris, the telegrams were arriving. Very nice, you've had a revolution, very good, congratulations, best of luck. How about a new offensive against the Germans? Let's defeat the Germans, which the provisional government, of course, accepted. They had to accept, because they owed a lot of money to these gentlemen in Paris and London. Now, these slogans played a powerful role in winning over the Soviets. I had a few historical observations here, but I don't have much time to develop them, because it will have emerged in the commissions here. The phenomenon of dual power is not unique to the Russian Revolution or to the proletarian revolution. You had elements of dual power in the English Revolution in the 17th century, which I think Rob dealt with yesterday, in the form of Cromwell's army, which was like a combination of the Soviets and the Bolshevik Party, as a matter of fact. They even had commissars in Cromwell's army, who were called agitators. Before every battle, the agitator would go and quote the Bible, a suitable text, to inspire the men to fight. You see, the Bible can play a revolutionary role sometimes. Well, in the 17th century, anyway. And Cromwell's army came into conflict with the Parliament, which is dominated by the big bourgeoisie, which Cromwell dispersed to dissolve the Parliament, because it was an obstacle to the revolution. The same as the Bolsheviks dissolved the Constituent Assembly later, which is also an obstacle to the revolution. And in the French Revolution, which Comrade Greg dealt with, I think, this morning, you had a similar phenomenon. And the fact of the matter is this, not just in Petrograd in 1917, but it's the case today in all countries. The ruling class could not exist. They couldn't rule for 1 week without the support of the labor leaders. It's a fact. And therefore, the task that Lenin put forward, that the Bolsheviks raised, were continually raising to the Soviet leaders, to the reformists, you must break with the bourgeoisie, break with the liberals, take the power, and carry out this program. Now, we must also explain that the reason for that, why Lenin took a very careful position, is that there were enormous illusions in the minds of the masses in relation to these leaders. And you've got to be very careful how you work out your slogans and tactics. Be very careful. There was an ultra-left trend among the Bolsheviks. There was an opportunist trend led by Kamenev and Stalin, and later Zinoviev also. But there were also ultra-left elements who put forward the slogan in April, "Down with the provisional government." A slogan which Lenin opposed, very strenuously opposed. So that's not a correct. We don't put that slogan forward, but rather put forward, because people had illusions in these leaders. You put forward the slogan, "All power to the Soviets." In other words, the working class must take power. Put it forward positively. And Lenin also put forward another marvelous slogan, which is very appropriate today. Patiently explain. Patiently explain to the workers. You know, in the press of the sects, the ultra-left, it's always the same stuff on the front page, shouting and screaming and bawling, you know, giving ultimatums to the working class and so on. It's not our method, or it should not be our method. You put forward your arguments in a reasonable way, in a positive way, and just explain to the workers what is necessary, that's all. I remember the Healyites, which was a particularly horrible sect in England, and in the front page of their paper, they had a daily paper, by the way. They'd always put, "Somebody betrays, Wilson betrays, trade union leaders betray." It must have been a very easy task to work out the front page of that paper, because all you're going to put is, "Will betray," and then you put a different name, that's all. Comrades, that's not the method. It's not our method. It wasn't Lenin's method. It wasn't Trotsky's method. You don't shout at the working class. Patiently explain what is necessary. Now, every revolution goes through different stages. As I said, there's the initial stage of everybody agrees and everybody's very happy, and that cannot last. You see that in Egypt now. You see it in Venezuela now. The second stage comes in which the workers, beginning with the most advanced elements, begin to realize that something is wrong, that this is not right, this is not what we fought for, that nothing has changed. And therefore they start to get very impatient and very frustrated. And there is the danger in this particular moment of ultra-left moods. There's a very big danger that the advanced workers can be separated from the mass. And that's extremely dangerous. It can lead to a disaster. One of the most criminal aspects of the sectarian ultra-left in all countries is that they're always trying to separate the advanced workers from the mass, which would convert them into an impotent minority. Whereas what the Bolsheviks did, you see this in 1917, what the Bolsheviks did was to win over the advanced workers and soldiers and educate them and turn them back into the mass, to win over the Soviets, to fight for a majority against the reformists. You see, it's very dangerous. The danger can be seen in Germany in 1919, which Rob dealt with this morning. The Spartacists were more advanced than the rest of the class, but the truth is they were a bit too advanced. They were too far advanced. And they tried to stage an uprising as a minority, and the social democratic leaders mobilized the more backward workers to crush them. Actually, he used the forces of reaction. He used fascist forces to crush them. But the Spartacists didn't have the support of the majority. That's the point. It was a complete disaster. It led to the assassination of Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht and destroyed the German Revolution. The Bolsheviks didn't behave like that, actually. But they had to. They had a hard struggle to convince the impatient workers that you must not break with the mass. They had a hard task. The discontent of the workers and the soldiers, and particularly the sailors of Kronstadt immediately came over to the Bolsheviks. By the way, they were not the same sailors that rose against the Bolsheviks in 1921. They're completely different sailors. They were backward peasant sailors from the Black Sea Fleet, but that's another discussion. Why were the sailors in particular more revolutionary than the soldiers? It's the same in Spain, by the way, in the 1930s. The sailors were red sailors. Well, the explanation is quite simple if you think about it. A ship is like a floating factory, and the sailors who go to work on ships tend to be from industrial workers anyway, with a workers' class consciousness. And I'll tell you what, nobody hates the officers more than the sailors. I'll tell you that now. Because they live in close contact with them on a ship, and they learn to hate them and despise them. And what really turned the mood in the army was when the provisional government announced a new offensive in April. More deaths, more slaughter, more suffering. For what? For nothing. And of course, the offensive ended in a terrible defeat. But there was a ferment of discontent among the soldiers, and the sailors in particular, which was expressed in a series of mass demonstrations in Petrograd, starting in April. That, by the way, led to a change in the government. You had the first coalition. Some of the Soviet, Kerensky joined the bourgeoisie. And in April, there were six reformist leaders in the coalition with the bourgeoisie. What was the attitude of the workers towards this? Were they against it? No, they were in favor of it. They thought like this. We had one of our leaders in the coalition before. Now we got six, so it must be six times better. They didn't realize that the bourgeoisie wanted these socialist ministers as a cover for their counter-revolutionary activity. Now let's see where I'm going now. I have to skip some points. In one of the meetings of the Soviet, Trotsky said the following, and this is typical of the Bolshevik line of argument. Very good advice, by the way. You can put it in all your newspapers in the national sections now. Do not trust the bourgeoisie. There's 3 points. First point, do not trust the bourgeoisie. Second point, control your leaders. Third point, rely only on your own forces. But anyway, they joined the government. The government of Prince Lvov, who was the prime minister. Guess what ministries they were given? Chernov, the leader of the SR, which is supposed to be a peasant party, Minister of Agriculture. Skobolev, Menshevik, Minister of Labour. In other words, you deal with the peasant uprisings and you put down the strikes. And Kerensky, Of course, minister of war. You take responsibility for the offensive. Well, I'll just skip some of this, yeah? Yes, already by May and June now the situation began to take one step further. There was now a blazing anger among the workers of Petrograd in particular. There'd been the Soviet Congress that was held, I think in May, in which the Bolsheviks were a minority, small minority. But under the pressure of the workers and the soldiers, the party put forward the idea of an armed demonstration to demand that the reformist leaders break with the bourgeoisie, to put pressure on the Soviets, if you like. The reformist leaders were quite alarmed and immediately issued the order that this demonstration be called off. Eventually, the Bolsheviks agreed to call off the demonstration. They retreated because they were afraid it would be seen as a provocation. Nevertheless, it was a big success. Finally, ironically, a demonstration was called on the initiative of the Mensheviks, actually, who proposed a unity demonstration. All the Soviet forces can demonstrate together. What occurred? The demonstration took place, and the Soviet leaders greeted it on the tribune, you know. But when the workers were passing before them, they were horrified to see that the workers were carrying the Bolshevik slogans. Peace, bread, land, down with the 10 capitalist ministers. Not down with the provisional government, down with the 10 capitalist ministers, which is different. And all power to the Soviets. And that was already an indication that the Bolsheviks were winning over the masses, particularly above all in Petrograd. Now, the fact of the matter is that the Bolshevik party could have taken power in June and July. It would have been quite easy. They had the majority in Petrograd. They had the majority of the sailors. And the demonstrations indicated that the support of the Mensheviks and the SRs was weakening. So why did they not take power? If they had taken power in July, the Russian Revolution would have ended up like the Paris Commune. Yet another heroic but tragic defeat. An episode. Because the Bolsheviks had won the advance guard, if you like, in Petrograd, yes. But the provinces was another matter altogether. They'd won the sailors in Kronstadt, yes. But the soldiers at the front was a different matter. The reformists still had considerable reserves of support in the population. What the Bolsheviks had done is that they won over the advance guard. But what is necessary is to win over the mass. To turn the advance guard against the mass is a criminal adventure. The Soviet leaders would have appealed to the provinces and they would have appealed to the front. They already launched a slander campaign that Lenin was a German agent, the Bolsheviks were financed by German gold and so on. They would have said, these people in Petrograd are counter-revolutionaries and they're against the revolution. And they would have been crushed without mercy. Now, the second stage, this stage of disappointment, of bitterness, of frustration, which occurs in every revolution, reached its culminating point in July. Buoyed up by the success of the earlier demonstrations, the workers and soldiers of Petrograd wanted to take power. That's a fact. They wanted to take power. They wanted to stage an armed demonstration, which in effect would have been a putsch, would have been an attempt to take power. Like 1919 in Germany. And the Bolsheviks did everything in their power to prevent this. The situation is approximately this. In this situation, the advanced workers feel that the power is slipping through their fingers. That's the case in Venezuela now. They feel that the power is slipping out of their hands, and they must do something to get the power back. It's a very dangerous situation. What the Bolsheviks finally had, when they saw that they couldn't prevent this, they put themselves at the head of the demonstration in order to prevent the worst outcome. With the result, although it was a defeat, naturally it was a defeat, the reactionary forces were prepared. They opened fire on the demonstrators. So some people were killed. But it wasn't the severe defeat that took place in 1919 in Germany. It was a defeat, but it wasn't a decisive defeat because the main forces of the party were preserved. But you must grasp this fact. A revolution is not a single act drama, and it's not a straight line. The Russian Revolution of 1917 lasted 9 months, from February to October, according to the old Russian calendar. But within that period of 9 months, there were periods of enormous advance, like the February Revolution, but there were also big defeats, as in July, and even a period of reaction within the revolution. The real position was this, and this is the case in every single revolution also. The first wave brings to power the reformists, the moderates, the compromisers, the parliamentarians. But behind the backs of the so-called moderates, the reactionary forces of the old regime are still there, and they hide behind these people to gather force, preparing for a counterblow once the situation is appropriate. From July to September, the pendulum swings violently to the right. The reformist leaders utilized the position in July to attack the Bolsheviks. There was a colossal campaign of slanders and attacks. Lenin, the German agent, and all this nonsense. They smashed the printing press of Pravda. Bolshevik leaders were sent to prisons. Zinoviev, Kamenev, and Trotsky later on also were sent to prison. And Lenin had to flee the country and go to Finland. They wanted to put him on trial as accused of a German agent. By the way, Lenin himself was prepared to go to trial. He wanted to hand himself over. He proposed to the Central Committee, look, I'll go and stand trial and I'll defend myself and I'll use it as a platform and so on. That was only one good thing that Stalin did in the whole of this period. He opposed it. But that wasn't difficult because all of the Central Committee opposed it. They said to Lenin, no, you're not gonna give yourself up. Because they will not put you on trial. You'll not have a platform. You'll be killed while trying to escape. You get on a train and go to Finland, which is what he did under protest. He didn't like it, but he had to accept it. You see, now the blows against the extreme left, if you like, the blows against the Bolshevik, prepared a general swing towards reaction. And the counter-revolutionary forces, which were always there, they were intact, now came forward in the form of General Kornilov, who began an offensive against the provisional government. There's not much gratitude in politics, comrades, I found over the years, very little gratitude. The reformists had saved capitalism in Russia. They saved the state. They saved General Kornilov. And he said, thank you very much, gentlemen. Now stand against a wall. Incidentally, here's an interesting point to return to the question of tactics and slogans. And it's an important point which I hope the comrades will understand. Comrades, you don't make a fetish out of any organization, not even the Soviets. You can have counter-revolutionary Soviets. Do you know that? Have you ever heard of a counter-revolutionary Soviet? You can have a counter-revolutionary Soviet. In July 1917, there were counter-revolutionary Soviets in Russia, leading the counter-revolution. And Lenin, in exile in Finland, in late July and August, was considering abandoning the slogan of all power to the Soviets. He said, maybe this slogan is no longer appropriate. And he considered putting forward another slogan, all power to the factory committees, which were closer to the working class. But you see, there again, you see how the dialectic of revolution, how it works. The whole situation in the Soviets was transformed again within a few weeks. But Lenin at that time, I think that he was beginning to become a little doubtful about the prospects of success. It was at this time, by the way, that he was writing that wonderful masterpiece, State and Revolution. And in Finland, he was together with Zinoviev. And at one time, he actually said to Zinoviev, he said, look, here is the proofs, here's the manuscript of my book, State and Revolution. I want you to take it. And if I am murdered, then you make sure it gets published. That's how his mind was working. But while Lenin was suffering agonies in Finland, the whole situation changed again. That's the point about revolution. Things change suddenly, quickly. General Kornilov began a march on Petrograd. He had a sizable army, including what is known as the Savage Division from the Caucasus. So he had guns, he had tanks, he had machine guns, and he got on trains. Trouble is that the drivers of the trains were revolutionaries, many of them Bolsheviks, and General Kornilov had a few accidents. You see, it's no good having tanks and guns if the trains end up in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of a desert or something. So you might have guns and tanks, but you've got no petrol, you've got no phone, you've got no electricity. Exactly the same thing that happened to the Kapp Putsch in Germany in 1920. The counter-revolutionary army had Berlin, but they had no phone, no electricity, no taxis, no nothing. General strike, and the counter-revolution collapsed. And here again we return to tactics, something which the ultra-lefts will never understand. Look, the Mensheviks and the SRs were oppressing the Bolsheviks, sending them to prison, smashing their printing presses. But the moment that Kornilov declared his counter-revolutionary offensive, the Bolshevik party immediately offered a united front to the Soviet leaders, the Mensheviks and SRs. Comrades, we have our differences. We still maintain our differences. But let us unite in action to defeat the fascists, defeat the counter-revolution. And that was a decisive step in winning over the mass of the Soviets. Because immediately all the lies and the slanders about German agents and counter-revolutionaries completely disappeared. And that marked a decisive change inside the Soviets. Now, there's an interesting book by a German called Oskar Anweiler, called Die Soviet, I think it's called something like Die Soviet, The Soviets, which gives the facts and figures, and it shows the sudden change in the composition of the Soviets from the end of August right throughout September. Of course, under these circumstances, they had to release the Bolsheviks from prison and lay off the attacks a little bit. Anyway, the attacks were not much use. In fact, they were counterproductive. Because every time a group of workers went on strike for higher wages, the press immediately came out, these are Bolsheviks, these are followers of Lenin. Maybe these workers had never heard of Lenin. But they said, well, if this is Bolshevism, we must be Bolsheviks. Long live Lenin. Well, that actually happened. So even the attacks against us can serve a useful purpose. Now, what happened next is very simple. The Bolsheviks took power. I haven't finished yet. Yes, but the reason why I put it that succinctly is after this period, then it was relatively easy. In one Soviet after another, the Bolsheviks won the majority. This is a massive swing. Now, among the many lies which are said about the Bolsheviks in 1917, and there are too many of them to count, the most stupid lie of all is the argument which is frequently repeated by these idiots in the university. You know, I was 7 years in a university. It was a very good university. It was an elite university. And I discovered one thing after 7 years. You find some of the most ignorant people in society in the four walls of a university. And I'm not talking about the students. This argument, which they put forward with a straight face. Ah, you see, it wasn't a revolution at all. It was really a coup d'etat. You see, what really happened is that Lenin was a tiny group of unrepresentative conspirators who seized power. Now, this is an interesting theory. And I wish one day that one of these guys will give me the secret of how this miracle was achieved. Because rest assured, I will put it into practice immediately. I mean, look, you've got to be a little bit stupid. You've got to be a little bit thick in the head. By what miracle does a tiny group of conspirators move 150 million people? That is some achievement. That really takes the biscuit. In order to do something like that, you'd need to be not a very good Marxist. You'd need to be something like the Wizard of Oz. Black magic. And it's absolute rubbish. I mean, if a small group of conspirators had wanted to take power in July, they could have done so. Why didn't they do that? Because they wanted to win the majority. Revolutions are not made by minorities. Although the active element of the revolution is always a minority, that's a separate matter. Lenin was not in the business of coup d'etats and putsches. He wanted to win over the majority. And only when they were sure that they had a majority, a firm majority in the Soviets, that was the question of an insurrection posed. And that's why I say it was the most democratic and popular revolution in history. There was, however, one other internal struggle, internal battle in the party leadership before October. Kamenev, Zinoviev, and Stalin were opposed to the insurrection. Although Stalin didn't play much of a role because he was an insignificant figure, he kept in the background. But Kamenev and Zinoviev, who were prominent leaders, continued to oppose the insurrection. They got scared. And Lenin was far away in Finland. He was very worried in case the Bolsheviks should waver at the decisive moment. He was even afraid that Trotsky might waver because Trotsky had recently joined the party and Lenin still wasn't quite sure. He needn't have worried about Trotsky. And what Trotsky put, Lenin was demanding, look, he sent a whole series of letters in October. Take the power now. Don't hesitate. Don't wait for anything. Take power now. The essential idea was correct. Because in a revolution, if you miss the decisive moment, you can wait for many years before you get a similar possibility that will emerge. Now, Trotsky put forward the following idea. Wait for the Second Congress of the Soviets, which had been already convened for late October. And they were convinced that they would get the majority. And this would put the necessary stamp of legality, of Soviet legality, on the seizure of power. It would remove the last remaining arguments of the reformists. Now, at first, Lenin objected strenuously to this idea, because as I said, he was afraid that the Bolshevik leaders were going to make a mess of it, were going to delay and delay. And as a crowning irony, the Military Revolutionary Committee of the Soviets was actually set up by the reformists. But by now it was taken over by the Bolsheviks and used as a means of organizing an armed insurrection to coincide with the Congress of Soviets. Now, about the insurrection itself, there is very little to say because, oh, by the way, I'm very sorry for our friends, the sectarians who want to have buckets of blood and object to the idea of a peaceful transition to socialism on principle. I regret to inform these ladies and gentlemen that the Bolshevik Revolution in Petrograd was a peaceful revolution. There was almost no violence, because by this time, nobody was prepared to fight and die for the provisional government. And the point is this. 9/10 of the task of the insurrection, 9/10, had already been carried out in the previous 8 months of patient political agitation, propaganda, and organization. One of the worst scoundrels who's recently written about the Russian Revolution, I had the misfortune to read his book, which is a very big book, Big Bullshit. He's a great expert on Russia from Cambridge University, Adam. Do you know this gentleman? Called Orlando Figgs. I think that's how you pronounce the gentleman's name. Fudge, I don't know. But anyways, it's some Orlando Figgs or Figgs. And he hates the Bolsheviks. But even this gentleman, he let something slip. There's a slip of the pen when he must have been very tired or he had too much Courvoisier brandy late at night at the college. He said, and I quote, "The insurrection in Petrograd," he said, "nobody noticed it." He said, "it was like a police operation." That is entirely accurate. I'll give you another example, even better example. Now, Hands up, all of you that like cinema, that like films. Put your hand up. Not many of you like films. Okay. Well, somebody likes films. Babak likes films. There's a great, in my opinion, the greatest film director of all times, in my opinion. A product of the Russian Revolution, Sergei Eisenstein. If you haven't seen his films, you must see these. They're wonderful films about the revolution. And he wrote a very good, he did a very good film called October, 10 years after the Russian Revolution, 1927. And in this film, there's a famous scene about a famous incident in the revolution, the capture of the Winter Palace. And in this scene, there's a crowd, it's very exciting cinema, very exciting cinema. The history, however, is a little bit defective. In this scene, you see workers and soldiers attacking the Winter Palace, climbing up the gates, throwing over bombs and hand grenades, falling down dead and wounded. Wonderful cinema. There's only one problem about that scene. More people were killed in making that scene for the film than were killed at the Winter Palace. It's an actual fact. A few extras were killed. It's not surprising with all these explosions. Some people got killed. Nobody was killed in the conquest of the Winter Palace. Nobody. They surrendered. And when you see in the film, you can see the battleship Aurora firing blasts against the palace. The Aurora did fire its guns. Yes, but they fired blanks because they didn't want to damage an historical monument. It was just to frighten the people inside. So as far as Petrograd was concerned, the Russian Revolution was a relatively bloodless affair. Moscow was a bit different because the local Bolsheviks made some mistakes. But power was firmly in the hands of the Russian working class. It was a relatively peaceful revolution. Where there was a real bloodbath, hundreds of thousands, millions killed, was in the civil war that followed. Soviet Russia was invaded by 21 armies of foreign intervention. They threw everything at the Soviet Republic. British, French, German, Belgian, Romanian, Poles, Czechs, Japanese, you name it. Pardon? Yes, Canadians, one or two Canadians as well. Don't forget the Canadians. They attacked. At one stage, and the Soviet Republic had no army. No. At one stage, the Soviet power was reduced to just a small area around Moscow and Petrograd. It was approximately the size of the old ancient Muscovy in the Middle Ages. And it is a fantastic achievement that one man, Leon Trotsky, organized the Red Army from nothing. And within 2 or 3 years, they defeated every single army of foreign intervention. They had to leave. How was this achieved? It was achieved in large measure by the colossal bravery and class spirit of the fighters of the Red Army. But it was also achieved by the internationalist policies of the Bolsheviks, who conducted internationalist propaganda among the foreign troops in their own language, with the result that every single one of the foreign armies mutinied, every single one, and refused to fight. The Prime Minister of Great Britain at that time was one Lloyd George, David Lloyd George. He was a Welsh man, and therefore very intelligent. No, Lenin actually said that he was very intelligent. He had advised the British communists to learn from Lloyd George. But in 1920, during the war of Poland and Russia, the Poles invaded Russia. Hast du gehört, my friend? In 1920, when the Poles invaded Russia, yeah, the dock workers of London sent a delegation to Lloyd George, threatening with civil war if they sent arms to the Poles, and they refused to send arms to the Poles. And in the British Parliament, when Lloyd George announced that he was withdrawing the British soldiers from Murmansk, from the north of Russia, and the Conservatives made a big fuss, they made a big scandal. Why are you withdrawing our soldiers from Murmansk? And Lloyd George calmly replied, in his beautiful Welsh accent, "Gentlemen, he said, I had to withdraw our soldiers from Murmansk Because they were infected with Bolshevik influenza. I said, at that time there was an epidemic of flu, which killed thousands of people. And Bolshevik influenza was a very particular dangerous type of flu. Comrades, I will have to end my lead off here, conscious of the fact that this is by no means the end of the story. The Russian Revolution tragically did not remain on the basis of Soviet democracy that Lenin and Trotsky had established. And I should make one point here. Lenin, Trotsky, and the Bolshevik Party never conceived of the Russian Revolution as an isolated national act. Never. If they had that conception, then the Mensheviks and SRs would have been correct, because the objective conditions for building socialism were not present in Tsarist Russia. But Lenin and Trotsky never had that conception. They considered the Russian Revolution as only the first step of the international revolution, and they brilliantly succeeded. The horrors of Stalinism were due to isolation under conditions of frightful backwardness. But that is a subject for another discussion. And finally, let's give the last word to these creatures that tried to attack and smear the name of Lenin and Trotsky, that they were violent, that they were vicious, they were bloodthirsty. Of course, an American president who drops the atom bomb on two defenseless Japanese cities when Japan is going to surrender, that's okay. That's not bloodthirsty. That's okay. Or the great Winston Churchill, who incinerated hundreds of thousands of people in the German cities by firebombs at the end of the war when it wasn't necessary. He's not a bloodthirsty monster, he's a hero. But when the Bolsheviks fight and use violence to defend the working class, they're monsters. Let's be clear about this. If you look at human history for the last 10,000 years, or say the last 2,500 years, there have been many slave revolts. All of them, without exception, were put down with the greatest violence and the greatest bloodshed by the ruling class. When Spartacus's slave army was defeated by the Romans, here in this country, the civilization that was Rome, they crucified over 6,000 slaves along the Via Appia all the way to Rome. When the Paris Commune was defeated, the Versailles reactionaries slaughtered at least 30,000 men, women, and children. Yes, but here, for once, the slaves armed themselves and fought back, and the slaves won. And for that crime, they are slandered and denounced and smeared by the defenders of the old order. Comrades, the banner of the Russian Revolution is a spotless banner of courage, of truth, of honor, and yes, of democracy and freedom. Tragically, that spotless banner was dragged through the mud by the crimes of Stalinism. Comrades, it is our duty, as the IMT, to reclaim the banner of October. It is our banner, the banner of the international proletariat, the banner of world revolution. And under that banner, the working class will conquer the world.